is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One. Thank you very much for taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And a reminder to those that are joining us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you'll find a link for the chat room. You could roll in there with the usual suspects if you have some observations you'd like to make during the course of the show, or if there is a question you would like for us to direct to our guest. That's a great place to go ahead and fold those in, and we'll pick that up and try to bring it into the conversation as the show goes forward. And if you have to leave halfway through the show, you can always catch up with what you missed or any other previous episodes we may have had over with the full archive at Blog Talk Radio. And that's also where occasionally, even though we're scheduled for an hour, and if you're with us live, the audio will die right at an hour, we may have another question we want to ask our guest, or our guest is halfway through answering a question. We will keep recording all the way towards the end, so you can catch those last few minutes of the after show there in the archive as well. Enough of that admin work. Let's get on with the show and kind of outline what we're going to do today. Is we want to look at the Navy side of personnel policy. How do we as an institution shape policy or respond to it? And all those things that limit or empower the effectiveness of our people, both on the deck plates, but also the people that we put in trust of command. What policies do we have out there in personnel are net positive, and which ones may be counterproductive today? Are there things that we can do better to balance the larger Navy goals with the requirements that we need to make sure that we meet in order to give the leaders that we entrust to carry out the day-to-day operations of our fleet the room they need to be effective and efficient leaders? We also are in a time of austere budgets where we have to reduce in strength, but we want to make sure that we do it smart and retain the right people and hopefully the best personnel that we can. We've been through this before. Are we a learning institution? How much flexibility have we been given by our civilian masters to perhaps adjust and learn from the past and to give the best response and the best result for the nation at the end of the day without breaking trust with our shipmates and those promises we've made to them in the past? And we have the ideal guest today to discuss this and perhaps a little bit more. Returning guest, Vice Admiral Bill Moran, U.S. Navy. He is the Chief of Naval Personnel, a P-3 pilot by trade. He's commanded at the squadron, wing, and group levels. But as the Chief of Naval Personnel for the last year, he's been primarily focused on overseeing the recruiting, personnel management, training, and development of all our Navy personnel. And he is really focused on improving communication between Navy leadership and sailors in the fleet, which I think we all agree is important as we go through a lot of these changes. Vice Admiral Moran, welcome back to Midrats.
Good evening, Sal. Great to be back with you on the air.
Yes, sir, and congratulations on coming up on about a year in the job. And what I wanted to do is kind of to shape the discussion, because I was talking with some folks last week, and we were talking about when you regardless of how much you prepare or you think you know a job, when you step into a new job, especially one that has a broad landscape of responsibilities like Chief of Naval Personnel, you can go in there thinking, you know, these are probably the three challenges I'm going to have or the three things I'm going to invest a lot of my time in. But after you're there for a while, that can change, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly over time. And I was just curious, when you're stepping into the job, what were those things you thought were going to be the major issues you wanted to get your hands around? And a year later, you know, how did that work out? How did that morph over time, if it did? And what are some tools that you use to keep yourself flexible and nimble enough to be able to adjust as the responsibility fleshed itself out for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. To be perfectly frank, I'm not sure I was prepared coming in here. It came up pretty quick for me, and thought I needed to be out there learning a lot more than trying to plan what I was going to do right on day one. So planning on how to get around to listen to sailors and families was my first focus. And we set up a trip planning effort, if you will, through the first year to try to get to all the fleet concentration areas, which we've done. In fact, I just got back from 5th Fleet a week ago, and that was the last of the fleet concentration areas, OCONUS, that we hadn't had a chance to be at. So that completed a year, and it completed our trip planning where we got around to see everybody. In that year, I've learned an awful lot. I would say when I first came in, prior to coming in, I talked to a lot of folks, both in the fleet, active and retired, and tried to gauge from them what they thought was the focus I should be taking on the job. And I think the one that came up all the time was the manning and the gaps at sea were a big focus, had been of my predecessor, and so I was catching a baton in the middle of the 400, if you will, and trying to bring it across the finish line. So I knew that was going to be an effort, and my view on that hasn't changed, although it has changed in the mechanisms that are available to us to man the fleet, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Force management is another line of operation for this business in the N1, and there's an awful lot involved there, from policy to law I can talk about. And then finally, a big effort, standing up of the 21st Century Sailor Office and dealing with a lot of resiliency issues that have been out there for the better part of 2 or 3 years was also, I knew it was going to be a big challenge. But what I've learned is that there's an awful lot of law and there's an awful lot of policy. Law is very little we can do to change the law, even when we think we need the change in the law to manage the force better. But policies are all in our purview, whether it's with the secretary or the CNO or myself. So got a lot of flexibility and opportunity to adjust policy to make things better for how we man and manage the fleet. So that's been a huge learning experience for me. I'm disappointed, frankly. I thought when I got here that we'd have all these wonderful tools available to us and be able to project and forecast future downturns in retention and recruiting. And what you find out is that we're still pretty archaic, and we have a lot of lagging indicators, but very few leading indicators. So the last year we've invested quite a bit of time and brain power on how we could do better in both of those areas. And we're getting better, but we still have a long way to go. And then lastly is just how much communicating is involved in this job, both internally to your own organization. And, of course, my workforce is spread out over 4 big areas, which is here in D.C., down in Millington, Tennessee, where all our detailers are, and community managers. Down in Pensacola, where NETSI, Naval Education Training Command, headed up by a 2-star, is. And then out at Great Lakes, where our schoolhouse is. So communicating the internal priorities has been challenging, and keeping everybody pointed in the same direction because of the geographic disbursement. But then even more importantly is communicating to the lowest echelons, all the way down to the deck plates and hangar bays, where sailors really are interested and hungry for information that we have in the personnel world, because it touches every single sailor, what we do on a daily basis. So the communicating piece I knew I was going to have to spend some time talking. I didn't realize how much time, and doing a lot of question answer periods, all hands calls, and frankly letting people vent a little bit has also been important in this job, because people are frustrated in areas, and sometimes they just need to let you know. And so that's really what's changed. And then I think the last one is I've been investing a little bit of time writing about how we can manage careers differently in the future. It's principally focused on the officer community. And we all know we're dealing in a different economic period. We're dealing with a global economy that's much different than what I grew up in the Navy in my early years. And so we we've got to think differently about how we manage careers, both on the recruiting side and then, of course, the training and education, and then ultimately keeping, as you said, keeping the best people we can in the Navy over the long haul. So that's a quick lap around a very fast year.
Well, let's hit some of those issues there as we go through them. There's a lot of discussion on the USNI blog and other places about the issues of generational problems, the millennials and all that. And I noticed in some of the pieces that you cited, and I think that was a piece you had on the Hill, that you referenced some companies that are dealing with similar issues and how they're addressing them. Can you kind of touch on that a little bit and where you see the way forward with issues dealing with the current young generation that's wearing the uniform?
Yeah, there are lots of Fortune 500 companies out there that are trying to address this differently, and I would say there's some pretty good publications out there. I just finished reading most of a book called Alliance, which has been out there on the bookshelves for better part of a few months, and it talks about how companies form, if you want to be successful today, you have to form an alliance with your employees. In other words, and we talk to sailors like this too. It's not how long you serve; it's that you served. And if you want to stay in the military, in the Navy in particular, we always want you to stay, but we also want you to have opportunity to get different experiences, get education, be able to start a family. All of those milestones in your personal life are connected to your professional life. And we are a very structured organization. It's an up-and-out organization. So this generation, the last 10 or 15 years especially, wants to have different experiences, but we have no off-ramps and on-ramps available to those, specifically on the officer front. There just aren't that many opportunities for young men and women to be able to go see if the grass is greener on the other side or gain some very valuable experience and then come back to our organization. And companies out there today, the Fortune 500 companies, are encouraging people to do that so that they do continue to mature and become more professionally qualified. And so when they come back to the organization under that alliance I talked about, they're better for the company. And I think we could do something very similar in the military, but that goes back to this conversation about law versus policy. And the law does not allow us to do it right now. So the services, I've talked to my Army counterpart, my Air Force counterpart, and they're all facing very similar challenges. And collectively, we're talking about how we would start engaging in this conversation with Congress and to see if there's an opportunity to maybe change the way we manage the officer corps in the future. So that's what that piece on the Hill was about, was to just start the conversation.
Yeah, I've gotten a little bit of a kick out of a lot of the conversations that have come on, just like my co-host mentioned about, you know, the millennials. As a younger cohort, Gen X, I kind of would stand up straight going, you know, when I was at JO, we were arguing about a lot of the same things. And it ties in, I think, to a word you used earlier on, archaic. I remember as a midshipman, you know, sitting down and they well before computers, and they put the acetate on the overhead showing your career paths. If you took the one that had the conventional submarine line and threw that in the garbage and you put it up today, it pretty much has remained the same. And there's been a lot of talk for a few years about it'd be great if people could, you know, whether it's partially paid or just, you know, take time off to pursue graduate education. The Navy won't promote, you know, that adds intellectual diversity and experience. Some people get a little bit of that through some of the fellowships we offer, but those are just dogs and cats here and there that are sometimes used as career pause points. And there are things, like you said, that, you know, we need to find the new gold water and the new nickels up on the Hill who can be on some advocates to adjust some laws to perhaps open up a few doors for us. But I also wanted to see how you could address some of our internal attitudes. Last month, there were a few articles out about how the selection of Blue Angels and the adjustment of the career command group, et cetera, and so forth, came out. And one of the justifications that came out from a senior leader was, when it was talking about having extra checks up the chain, was that wanted to make sure that being a Blue Angel wouldn't hurt somebody's career path. And we've all had these discussions, not involving Blue Angels, of course, at various other times. How much of that limitation is structural, that we have that little flexibility that we can't brief into the boards? Is there something wrong with our boards that we can't properly explain or understand that? Or is this an intellectual problem of selecting in our own image, that when something is weird, there's not a critical mass of people out there in a selection board that goes, you know, why are you pressing 50 for this? This is 100. This is a good deal. So how much internal is cultural and habit, and how much of that is actually external, where you would need to have your advocates on the Hill to give you the running room that you need?
And that's a mouthful, Sal. I think you covered the landscape here. It's both, of course, and I think we're as much focused on the structural aspects of a career that it makes it challenging to value on the boards the things like education. You know, this was a big part of Buzz Snodgrass's paper and the dialogue that we've had and continue to have with JOs around the fleet over their frustration with, hey, I'd really like to go get an in-residence degree somewhere early in my career, but I fear if I do that, I'm not going to be able to compete for, you know, the next milestone, whether it's a statutory promotion to O4 or department head, you name it. And I think that is a real fundamental challenge with the culture that we've built in the Navy in terms of how we measure a career. So as you know, the boards really look at their performance over everything else, and that's judged on how people do on their fitness reports. And I think part of our problem in the frustration with naval aviation in particular is that everybody starts the race to that first big cut, and which is the O4 board. They all start the race at different points in time, and an aviator can take 2 to 3 years to get qualified. By that time, a submariner and a surface officer, an ensign, JG, they've already raced through, you know, the better part of their first sea tour, and they're starting to think about their first shore tour. And so when you map out the first 8-9 years of a career, by the time they come before that O4 board, you've got a lot of officers that have had 2 to 3 tours and their measured performance in that time, where an aviator might have 1.5, maybe 2 tours in there. So it's difficult for the board to judge that if that's all they're looking at. And then you take a kid, you take a young man like Buzz Snodgrass, who went to MIT before he ever started, and so he starts the race even further behind the rest of them. And these are institutions we want young men and women to go to at some point, whether it's right out of the academy or ROTC or maybe a few years later. But those, when someone does something like that, they are definitely disadvantaged in the way we structure year group management in promotion boards. So that's the law piece that we would need some help with, is not having to manage everybody's career solely by year group, solely by standing in line waiting your opportunity. And in some cases, if you choose to take a path less traveled, you are going to end up disadvantaged, even though you're doing things that are extremely valuable, like going and getting a degree, an advanced degree, or other things. So we could talk about a lot of those things, but that conversation with Buss and his team and several lieutenants since that point have really highlighted that frustration. If I could just transition real quick to this, we have one program that was authorized about 5 years ago called Career Intermission Program. It's a pilot program that allows us to let young men and women, officers and enlisted, take up to a 3-year sabbatical in the Navy to go get their degree, start a family, take another job, do the things I talked about earlier. The problem with the pilot is that it's limited to 40 a year. When you've got 324,000 folks, that 40 is a pretty small sampling, and it's also listed as a pilot, so there aren't too many officers out there who want to roll the dice on their career on a pilot program. So we've had limited takes on that, about 50%, 50, 60% takes. And yet everyone who's taken it that has come back to the Navy has advanced and promoted and been selected for the next milestone and continue to do well. So we've been actively working with congressional staffers to try to expand that from a pilot program to more of an institutionalized program. So far haven't gotten the support to do that because they want to see more runtime on the pilot. And my discussions with them is I think we've seen enough anecdotal information that we ought to expand this thing because it'll never reach it will never get the momentum going with such a small sampling. We've got to do a bigger piece to this. So that's an example of the kind of policies that we could implement that we need help from Congress on.
When you approach these problems, and I guess one of the things, I'm going to go back to your Hill article again. There was a lot of discussion in those articles that you refer to in that article about internal values and the importance of the internal values of the members of an organization. Is there an approach that you all are looking at to address making sure we attract people with the proper internal values to the Navy?
I'm not sure I'm following the question. So can we, on the enlisted front, it's very much a very limited population of folks we can go after. I know you've heard this stat, but it's about 25 to 28% of high school graduates today qualify, even can get in the door at MEPS to sign up. So even with that limited population, our quality that we look at is measured in terms of high school graduation rates and how well they do on the entrance ASVAB scores, and then how many of them have had some history with the law or other behaviors that would otherwise disqualify them. And our measure, those measures continue to be at historic highs. So, and the population of those recruits has, the average age has gone up by a couple of years. So we're getting older, sometimes high school graduates that have been in the workforce, so they're a little bit more mature. So overall, the quality coming in is good. In terms of values, I think, it largely depends on the interface and the interaction between the recruiters and the recruits to find out if these young men and women are serious about service. And I think that's the value that we value the most is are people joining the Navy because they want to serve. It turns out that many do, but also many are attracted by the pays and benefits and the education opportunities after they've served. So it's a mix of those things. On the officer front, I think, when you're looking at 15 or 16,000 applicants to the Naval Academy, for example, every year, and we pick 11, 1,200, that's a pretty strong cut line based on a lot of interviews and a lot of application processes. But there aren't any criteria that I'm aware of that go to your value piece other than are they team players, are they the whole person concept, and some pretty objective measures as opposed to the subjective pieces. Does that answer your question?
Eagle One? Oh, he may have dropped off. We'll wait for him to call back in. I wanted to go back and because you mentioned briefly something that I wanted to pull the thread on a little bit, because I know if I heard more than usual, you sure did. We do boards every year. But this year's Lieutenant Commander /04 board, I had both Facebook messages, emails, and on Twitter, a couple of people who got passed over from that board that really got knocked in the knees. And I will give the Navy some credit here. There was a fair bit of open discussion and putting some numbers out there. And I wanted to give you an opportunity to speak to that for a bit on what your thoughts are two things about the 04 board that has come up is there's the breakout to selection by community and designator. There's some rather significant differences there. And there's also, when you look at it just from a numbers point of view, a significant breakout between both the staff's numbers, but also what our Army friends call the combat arms era, the surface warfare, aviation, and submarine communities. What were some of those results of the 04 board that you've heard the most about that perhaps some of the results that give you some concern are something that should drive us perhaps to make some adjustments where we can?
Yeah, Sal, this has been a tough one. The community that's been affected the most on this last statutory board for 04 was the aviation community. And as a senior aviator, I'm particularly concerned. Air Boss, Vice Admiral Dave Buss and I have been on the phone weekly talking our way through this. And I would tell you there's a lot involved here. And if I tried to go explain everything, I'd probably lose half of the audience because some of it's law, and some of it is just the nature of the tyranny of numbers. And so let me start with the basics. You have to, unless we talk about just the combat arms piece, the submariner, surface, and aviation community, otherwise known as the unrestricted line. That's our largest population of officers that are put before a board together. They're the largest grouping that we compare records against each other. And so this year it was a large number in a 1,200, 1,300 range. And that was a larger group than we've had in the past because DOTMA law, that's the law that governs officer promotions, it requires us to select people for 04 between the 9 and 11-year mark because of some pretty incredible retention since about 2007, 2008 when the recession hit. We've got quite a few folks that are staying beyond between 15 and 20 years that are in the 04, 05 ranks for obvious reasons. Once they get there, they might as well stay to 20 and get a retirement out of it. That number is so large and the retention so good that they're not generating as many vacancies as we need, and so you can't promote folks if there aren't vacancies to promote into, and that has restricted some of our numbers. When you couple that with what I described earlier about the horse race starting differently for those communities, and the fact that the minimum service requirement is different for pilots, which is 8 years from the time of winging. So most pilots that entered the Navy are before the 04 board, whereas submariners and surface warfare officers, their MSR is 5 years, and so they've already culled a large majority of their herd, if you will, long before the 04 board. And the NFOs is 6 years, so they've culled that herd a little bit too. So I'm not trying to make excuses for the numbers because the numbers were pretty poor for the aviation community, but it is a bit of a challenge with the numbers that we had before us this time. A large population with fewer vacancies, and the vast majority of folks that were up for the board were pilots. So when you couple all that together, I think we must do a better job this coming year. On either doing separate panels, like I think some of the folks have echoed to you. We are looking very hard at whether that's something we should do and what the consequences could be to that. But in the end, we've got to make sure that we have community health across aviation, submarine, and the surface force. And that means we select enough O4s so that there's selectivity for department head. And we didn't accomplish that this year for aviation, so that has got us concerned. Is that hopefully that opens it up a little bit, but there's no doubt that we've got to do better. Now on the other communities that you talked about, what we call restricted line and staff, they're so small that one or two or three numbers will make those percentages move around pretty significantly, and they've got less of a pyramid structure and more of a cylindrical structure to their promotion system. So they select at a higher rate, and I know that frustrates the URL communities out there. But when you look at the numbers, they are pretty slim from the numbers going into the board and the numbers we need coming out of the board to populate those communities. I'll stop there because it's a lot.
When you out in the fleet and you're talking to the people about these issues, what are they saying to you, sir? What are their comments to you about some of these factors in their lives?
Well, much of what we talked about earlier, Eagle One, in that they don't understand why an aviator who knocked it out of the park in his first tour, his or her first tour, and then goes to the FRS, which is the Fleet Replacement Squadron, which is, as an aviator, that's we send a lot of high-quality folks there, or the training command where they're flying and they're competing against other aviators, again, high-quality, and other staffs. But they only have maybe one or two fitness reports while they're there, and they may be breaking out to the top. But they, when you compare it against their submarine and surface counterparts of the same rank, there's a significant difference between – potentially a significant difference between those two career – or three career paths. So they're frustrated because they don't see how they can get there unless we break apart the panel so that you're only comparing apples with apples, i.e. aviators against aviators, submariners, and so forth. So that's one of the issues that they brought up, and they want. It was brought up in Bus's paper, and so it's one that's under consideration, and we will make those adjustments before this next board. And it goes back to the comment about we've got to ensure community health. Community health just means that we have selectivity, that not everybody who's picked is always going to go on to department head, for example, because we need other people, other O4s around the Navy to do other things. But we do want to be able to fill out every community with the right number of department heads. And this year, based on the selections, we're not going to be able to do that across the board in aviation, which is unfortunate, but we're going to have to make adjustments to make up for that.
Over on the enlisted side of the house, you know, one of the items in the last half decade that, you know, we're still hearing echoes about was the force reductions, were the ERB, the Enlisted Retention Board, and a couple other programs were in there that really had some second and third order effects that probably weren't optimal for everybody involved. I know this has, you know, really been under the spotlight for both our senior officer and enlisted leadership to see what force shaping tools we're using to perhaps do it a little bit better than what was done before. What are some of the steps that we're looking at in that regard, and what should some of our enlisted personnel expect should additional significant reductions need to take place? What processes may they look forward to, and how may it differ than what has been done in the recent past?
Yeah, a wonderful question. No question that early in my tenure, everywhere I went, we continue to get the same issue raised. When are we going to do another ERB in the fleet? And my answer is always firmly, your CNO has said not on my watch, and I will tell you I don't need it on my watch because we've stabilized the enlisted force where we weren't stabilized before. And what I mean by that is, of the 90-plus rates we have in the Navy, we have tried to stabilize advancement opportunity and manning levels across those rates so that we don't have to take involuntary action, if you will, which is what the ERB was, forcing people out because they wouldn't convert to other rates and losing some really good sailors in the process. So we don't need to do that now because we're stable across the what we call the FITIP, the long-range budget planning process, which goes out 5 years. We're in a nice position as a Navy. We're currently manned at about 324,000 today, which is what we should be manned at based on the size of the Navy we have, and we're projected to be at about 324,000 5 years from now. So unlike the Army and the Air Force, who are going through some significant downsizing. We're not. So there's no need to use any kind of involuntary measures. And now that we are balanced, and more balanced, I should say, and more stable, if we do have to make any kind of adjustments to force structure in the future, we can do it through what I call natural means, either turning down accessions and bringing people in, or allowing people to leave sooner, reaching retirement either through an early retirement program or through just not reenlisting as many people. That today we reenlist people at about 98% of those who want to stay in the Navy, so we're in a pretty good place there. So we can make adjustments, the dials, if you will, on the front end and the back end to shrink the force if we had to. But I do not forecast any need to do that as long as we don't hit another sequestration or something like that in the future.
Well, you just stole the question I was going to ask as to whether or not the Navy was going to avoid the bloodletting that the Army seems to be going through with it, getting rid of O4s well before their time. When you're out there talking to the troops and on the deck plates, are they asking questions about their potential for promotion and stuff? How does that fit into this scheme? Is this a current rate of retention and all that allow more flexibility as far as keeping more senior people, or is there going to be instances of reduction in the numbers of E6s, E7s type of progress?
The forecast that we've got, you're right, retention is very good across the Navy in the aggregate. There are certainly areas where retention has our attention because it's not as good as we'd like. And I can go through each one of those if you want. But the majority of the Navy's retention statistics are, again, above historic norms, and it continues to be pretty good in a fiscal environment where the unemployment rates come down from the mid-9s to the low 6s. Normally, we would see retention following that downturn, but we're not. And I think part of it is the fact that youth unemployment continues to be about twice the unemployment rate, so it's hovering in the high 12-13% range. So that's helping us in terms of keeping retention high. But I also think our pay and compensation matches and exceeds a lot of what sailors could see or find on the outside. So that continues to be an attractive option. You know, one of the biggest surprises for me when I took this job was asking folks, you know, so what's our historical retention to 20 years in the enlisted force? And it shocked me that 13-14% of sailors who walked through the door at Great Lakes stayed at 20 years. And I thought, you know, when I got in this job, man, I got to save every sailor. Everyone's got to stay in the Navy. And lo and behold, nope, that ain't the case there, CMP. You only need about 13 out of 100, and I was just floored by that. On the officer side, it's around 35%, still much lower than I had imagined. But then when I look back at my class at the Naval Academy, and along the way, you kind of watch the statistics go from one year to the next, and yeah, it's about right. You know, not many stick around at 20, let alone 30 or 33 like me. So it's those were kind of interesting statistics for me. But it goes to the point that if you're retaining a lot of sailors, it's going to suppress advancement opportunity. If you retain a lot of officers, it causes problems in vacancies, which allow promotions in the 04, 05 ranks. So we're seeing a little bit of constipation in the senior officer corps because retention has been good, but I think that will turn now that we've come off the recession numbers and senior officers start to leave. On the enlisted front, I don't see, other than in selected communities, I don't see pressure that has me completely concerned that I can't move some monetary levers around to entice folks to stay. But ultimately, those small percentages of 13-14% on the enlisted front and 35% or so on the officer front, my biggest concern is, are we keeping the right 13-14% and the right 35%? And that's where we have to be better, more agile in how we manage careers in the future.
Yeah, bingo. We touched on this subject just a little bit when we had you on for the first time with Bus, but I wanted to bring it back again. And, you know, those, especially the aviation side of the house, those that made it through the 04 board and are progressing forward, there's a large percentage of those guys that are putting on their oak leaves and are saying, but you know what? I don't want my boss's job. They look at Commander Command and are kind of squinting their eyes and maybe rolling their cheeks a bit about it. And a lot of that has to do with something that, again, it's nothing new. It's been around for a while. The discussion is, you know, precedes even when I was a midshipman, because that 3,000-mile screwdriver, ever since they created the wireless, and now we have technology from voice over IP to real-time streaming video at the tactical level. And there's some effort, kind of a contra trend from that micromanaging and putting on additional burdens to command while taking away a lot of authority to try to rebalance that, to try to move back towards giving a little more of what should make command that's been missing as of late. What are some of the views and discussions from that perspective on looking at what can we do to make Commander Command what it should be and perhaps take some of those very talented individuals who you would want to aspire to command who decide, no, really, I don't want that job?
Yeah, Sal, that's I hear it all the time. This is a popular topic anywhere we go, and we read about it quite a bit on the blogs and in articles that are written by young officers and mid-grade officers. So it's real. I go up to the Command Leadership School every month and talk to the new classes up there, and it's filled with, boy, it seems like about 50 PXOs and pre-major command folks that go back up there for a couple weeks of re-blueing, if you will. They're coming out of joint jobs on their way to be an XO or a CO. And they're all pretty excited about where they're headed, but they offer the same views that you just did, that it does feel like Big Brother's watching over their shoulder a lot. And the 3,000-mile screwdriver that you and I grew up with probably is close to 15,000 miles now, and it leapfrogs across multiple satellites to get there. It's a fact of life now, though. We have to learn to live with that. But ultimately, you know, our job back here is to relieve some of that burden so that that COs feel like they've got authority and autonomy. And that autonomy is difficult to get when you have these long screwdrivers that you described. So we are looking at things that we can do to put that back in a CO's into his toolkit, if you will, and be able to have that autonomy. I mean, that's our culture as a Navy. We aspire to command. Command is the center of the Navy at the lowest possible level. So if we're losing people's interest in going to command, we're going to lose the Navy. And in the triad, I talk about the triad all the time, that command, master chief, XO, and CO combination is the central focal point of our Navy. So there are some things we're trying to do. In my world, I could tell you that I think COs are the best judge of talent in their own organization. So what can we do to give them more authority to have an input and have an influence on who advances and who promotes? And there's several things we've done here in the last year to do that. And I can certainly share with you some pieces through, you know, I'll send them to you that you can put up on your web page if you want. It would take the rest of this hour to go through them all, but there's several things that we're doing to try to give the COs a little bit more authority to determine who the best are and who should promote. But there's also a lot of other things we can do better in giving them time back in their command and not doing a lot of stuff that we've mandated over time on Navy Knowledge Online, training courses. You know, there are dozens of things that we've layered on top of COs to make it very challenging for them to be out there mentoring and flying or operating and training, and that's what they want to do. Ultimately, they just want to be out there operating, and when we got them busy doing other things, reporting everything they got to report, it suppresses their excitement for doing what we all should want them to do.
When you look at the problems facing our COs and our younger officers, is there an impact that a zero defect mentality has on people in that they're not willing to take some risks which might be beneficial for them and for the Navy down the road? I mean, I can't imagine that a Nimitz who ran a ship aground and was later kind of acquitted by his court-martial, but for that, you know, that he would have a chance in today's Navy, given some of the attitude of the zero-defect personalities. Is there room for people to be a little maybe more aggressive and not worry as much about having an unblemished record, or are we walking that line of it's perfect or get out?
Yeah, I can certainly understand, and certainly I believe that when I was.
You don't want? I think we lost you.
You still there?
Vice Admiral Moran, you still there?
I'm still here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. I don't know about Sal.
Okay. Well, maybe it's just you and me talking right now. You can want.
Oh, okay.
But that's okay.
The problem was on my end, evidently. Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's all right. So yeah, zero defect mentality is a popular theme, and it's a perception that's real. There's no question that folks feel that way, and it's been around, as Sal has said, for a while, and it's not gotten any better. And really, the folks that are in control of this is leadership, and we are talking a lot about how we can. How we need to reverse this to the degree that people don't feel like they can't take risks, operational training risks. We have to enable people to make judgments on their own, especially COs. And judgment's all about how much risk are you willing to take, and is it the right call? And when it isn't the right call, have they learned from it, and can they be better COs and better department heads, better aviators, submariners, whatever? So I think we all owe that to our subordinates, and COs owe it to their department heads, and it works all the way down. And we have to change that attitude if that's and it is pervasive out there in the way people talk about it. So we do have a lot of work to do on that.
Kind of hitting with the theme, there was a lot of talk. Maybe 12, 18 months ago, a little program, a nice couple of releases for the reductions in administrative distractions, the RAD program, you know, the ongoing discussion about, you know, why do I need to produce a report for a report for a report? And a lot of that has to do with over the years, like a dog acquires beggar weeds, as a large organization, we've required more and more layers of staffs, bureaucracies, that everybody wants their report to create their graphs and their metrics. And a good description of how, and I know it's not easy as Vice Admiral Moran getting on a phone and saying, hey, you two combine and you get rid of all your SESs and your GSs are here by next fiscal year and we'll be fine. In his book, Duty, former Secretary of Defense Gates mentions that, you know, his closing of Joint Forces Command in Virginia created his worst enemies he had on the Hill of his entire tenure there that had an echo effect his whole period of time there. So there's a lot of politics involved with reducing that administrative overhead. But it's not just job savings. These different layers of staffs, these different layers of reporting requirements, C2 diagrams that need three legal-sized pieces of paper to properly diagram, it creates a lot of that administrative overhead and a lot of that time from your COs, whether they're commanders, captains, or even admirals. Have we made any progress as an institution to really be able to move that needle, or are we in a circumstance kind of what Gates saw and what we were talking about before, that you can only go so far without having the right people on the Hill, in Congress, that can help write laws that enables you to do the consolidation from the staff and the support level that you need to really be able to impact the commanders and that administrative overhead?
Some of it is the external pieces. Anything that's in law, you know, it's part of the National Defense Authorization Act. We have to comply. We don't have a choice. And there are several examples of that. And so the ones that we can affect are the ones that Navy generates their own internal policies on. And what we tend to do is we just, as I said earlier, we just stack them on top of each other. We never take a deep breath and breathe through our nose and look how we can maybe take one or two of those reporting requirements and blend them into one of another and reduce the overall requirement. One of the things I hear out in the fleet from time to time is from aviators to say, it takes me longer to report on a flight than it does to fly the flight. And that's pretty sad commentary about the reporting requirements. So there is a lot of effort underway right now, and I say that probably ad nauseum, and people are tired of hearing it. They want to see it. We've taken some steps in general military training, which is in my lane, and NETSI down in Pensacola has done a nice job of reducing the number of training requirements, but also allowing COs to determine when they should do those training requirements. They're the best judge, again, of when they need it. And so we're trying to free up their time to make those calls. And there's several other examples, but they're all small. There's no big needle that's going to swing here, Sal. But I think over time we will see I'll call it a significant reduction, but at least a meaningful reduction for COs that you wake up 2 years from now and you'll see quite a bit of difference in what we have in reporting requirements today and what we'll have in the future. We got to keep working on it.
As you, I think Sal touched on this earlier on, but as you finish your first year as Chief of Naval Personnel, and you're looking forward, what goals or where do you want to end up? What's it going to look like when you're done, Admiral? Where do you plan to head with this, with what you're doing at your current position?
Yeah, I was cautioned when I took the job by several of my predecessors that said that most decisions you make in this business, you don't see the fruits of that labor for 2 to 5 years down the road, and because it's policy and this big ship of manpower moves really slow, even though you feel like you're cranking a bunch of turns, it doesn't move as fast as you'd like. And I agree with that. So the long-term planning that we're doing is really focused for the officer front is on how we manage careers differently. What things can we set into motion now that gain traction with Congress and with OSD that allow us more flexibility in managing careers? We've got to go there. I'm absolutely convinced of that, and I'll do my best to lay down some bricks that start making a path to that end state. I won't see it. My successor probably won't see it, but I hope, you know, someday when I'm rocking on the porch that I can look back and say we started that program and now look where it's taken us. So that's a bit of long term, but there's plenty that we can do in the near term, and we've taken steps to do it to improve manning, to try to improve training, and those things are near term that we can go after, and we are going after to try to shorten training tracks. For example, a fire controlman today, from the moment they walk out of boot camp to the time they get to the ship, is taking on average almost 2 years. Well, hell, we can get a master's degree in 2 years for most officers. There's no reason on earth that it takes us that long, but it requires investment in training capacity, instructors, and trying to get a whole number of Aegis systems more standardized so that the training can be standardized. And all of those things are being addressed, and there's some really good investments that will pay off here in the next year or two. Those things are... they're on the horizon, and I'm hoping we're going to get out in front of it. To go back to your original question, what I hope at the end of all this, that we increase trust in the fleet, both at the enlisted level, that we continue to demonstrate that they can trust us in terms of trying to stabilize the force and give them better opportunities. On the officer front, that we get it right in terms of our promotion opportunities, and they see meaningful steps being taken to change the way we can manage their careers, the way they want to manage their careers. And then in the end that we've stabilized the Navy in the long term, especially on the manpower front, which I feel like we are. The numbers are pretty good, and that we're able to put enough flexibility in our management levers, if you will, that when we start to see movement in the wrong direction on retention and recruitment, that we're able to act in time to, as we like to say around here, hit the pitch, not swing ahead of it or behind it. So that's kind of what I hope to see in the next year, that we're marching in that direction.
You had the, well, I consider it a pleasure. One of the things I miss the most about active duty is actually getting out there and deploying. But you recently came back from a visit to the USS George Herbert Walker Bush CVN-77, who's now doing the nation's bidding as she was designed to do and doing it well from what we've seen. But with our carriers and our air wings over the last decade plus, everybody's familiar with the Army and the Marine Corps op tempo, but the Navy hasn't been doing its knitting in a corner either. And there are the 9-month deployment, the 8-month deployments. And that's really where a lot of people make their decisions, whether they're going to reenlist or whether they're going to get out once their obligation is done. What are some of the issues related to operational tempo and 6-month-plus deployments back-to-back that you're hearing from the fleet? And have any of those given you a couple of questions for your staff there in Millington to look at? They're not new problems, but coming out there fresh from the fleet after a long time, what are those things that are coming up related to op tempo that you're hearing from our sailors?
Well, thanks for the question, Sal. When we were on Bush, we literally landed there the morning after they had launched their first strikes into northern Iraq, and this at the 6-month point in their scheduled 9-month deployment. So they knew ahead of time they were going for 9 months, but here we are landing right when they're at their 6-month point. So a lot of them could have looked at that point in time as, I would normally be arriving in Virginia Beach right about now, and here I am, I got 3 more months to go, but I didn't hear that at all. What I heard instead was, hey man, we're pumped, we're up here doing this now, we're in the fight, we got a purpose, we got a mission, and we don't want to leave. We're there. So these long deployments are tough if the purpose isn't clear, and they're even tougher when it's unpredictable. So if somebody's out there on a 6 or 7 month deployment and they get extended, or they leave early, or they get delayed, all of those issues have occurred in the Navy in the last 5 years and beyond. Stennis had 2 long back-to-back deployments with a very short 5 months in between. Eisenhower had something similar. They were deployed 10.5 months with a couple months in between. And you could go down the line of the number of carrier strike groups and air wings associated that have had unpredictability thrown into their lives. And that's what frustrates sailors more than anything else. So CNO and the fleet commanders are working hard to go back to that stability where they're trying to stabilize the supply-based nature of the Navy to the greatest degree we can. I tell sailors all the time, the beauty is we're in high demand. Unfortunately, we're in high demand too, because it means we're out there and people want us out there. Once we get through, I would say, a pretty significant maintenance backlog, we'll be able to stabilize those deployments, and that's going to take a couple of years at least. Until then, we've just got to let sailors up front know and their families know if it's going to be a long deployment or what length it's going to be, and then stick to that the best we can. That's the only way you're going to solve this issue. And there's no question that those long deployments are wearing on the fleet. And we see it in specific rates, especially those what we call sea-centric rates or occupations where you never leave the ship. So there's a lot going on right now to try to address the deployment lengths into the future, and I think we'll see that change here in the next couple of years.
Well, Admiral, again, it's been one of those fast hours. I want to thank you for coming on our show again. I want to thank you for your answering our sometimes dubious questions and for putting up with my technical difficulties. Is there anything you would like to say that we haven't asked you that you want to end this show with?
Hey, thanks for the wrap up. I would say that that visit to the bush and the visit out to Japan earlier and Sixth Fleet earlier is, in spite of all the things we say about this generation, especially this millennial generation, whoever they are, these guys are committed. They get it. They make us proud every day. And I couldn't be more proud of what they do. You know, the last 13 years of our nation's life has been fighting wars, and it's been by largely the millennials. And so if we, to Sal's, I've seen your commentary, Sal, I couldn't agree with you more. We are much more alike than we are different across generations, especially when it's about service. So thanks for the opportunity to talk about them, and thanks for some great questions tonight.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you taking time this afternoon to spend with us, and wish you the best going forward.
Okay, thanks.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for today's MidRats. And make sure and join us next week when our guest will be James R. Holmes, Ph.D. He is a professor of strategy at the Naval War College. We're going to have him on to discuss the very 21st century lessons from the First World War. Till then, hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. Sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.